طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. Minnesota Democrat Representative Betty McCollum has introduced her most comprehensive legislative initiative yet to promote Palestinian rights, H.R. 2590, the Defending the Human Rights of Palestinian Children and Families Living Under Military Occupation Act. The bill provides that the U.S. assistance intended for Israel's security must never be used to violate the human rights of Palestinian children, demolish the homes of Palestinian families, or to permanently annex Palestinian lands. Peace can only be achieved by respecting human rights, especially the rights of children. And this includes the U.S. taking responsibility for how taxpayer-funded aid is used by recipient countries, Israel included. Congress must stop ignoring the unjust and blatantly cruel mistreatment of Palestinian children and families living under Israeli military occupation. The legislation has 13 original sponsors: Representatives Bobby Rush, Illinois; Danny K. Davis, Illinois; Andre Carson, Indiana; Marie Newman, Illinois; Ilan Omar, Minnesota; Mark Pocan, Wisconsin; Raul Grijalva, Arizona; Rashid Tlaib, Minnesota; Ayanna Presley, Massachusetts; Corey Bush, Missouri; Jamal Bowman, New York; Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, New York; and Jesus Garcia, Illinois. Massachusetts only has one sponsor, Ayanna Presley. What is interesting is who is missing. When McCollum introduced her first bill protecting Palestinian children over 4 years ago, Catherine Clark, Jim McGovern, and Seth Moulton were also sponsors. Where are they on this bill? Illinois has four of the original 13 sponsors. California has none. Where are the left coast progressives? Palestine is still the third rail of American politics. McCollum's bill is also supported by over 75 organizations, including Palestinian human rights groups, U.S.-based organizations led by Palestinian Americans and Muslim Americans, and U.S.-based Palestinian solidarity groups. Notably, the bill is being supported by J Street, marking the first time this liberal Zionist organization has publicly backed a legislative initiative that seeks to condition weapons to Israel. McCollum's latest bill both reiterates her opposition to Israel's ill treatment of Palestinian children and the possibility of its formal annexation of additional West Bank land, and expands her critique of Israeli occupation policies, making it the most extensive legislative effort ever introduced in the Congress to end U.S. complicity in the human rights violations endemic to Israeli military policy. The bill notes that Israel's drive to perpetuate its control over the occupied West Bank results in other serious violations of international law, including the unlawful demolition of Palestinian homes and the forcible transfer of Palestinian civilians. These policies create oppressive conditions that leave Palestinians with no other choice than to leave their homes and lands. Israel's drive to perpetuate its control over the occupied West Bank results in other serious violations of international law, including the unlawful demolition of Palestinian homes and the forcible transfer of Palestinian civilians. This renewed congressional focus on Israel's forcible displacement of Palestinians is well-timed, as Israel imminently plans to forcibly displace nearly 2,000 Palestinians in Jerusalem through the demolition of homes, Silwan, and forced evictions in Sheikh Jarrah. Opposition to Israel's forced displacement of Palestinians is operationalized in McCollum's bill by prohibiting U.S. funding for the seizure, appropriation, or destruction of Palestinian property and forcible transfer of civilians in the Israeli-controlled and occupied West Bank in violation of international law. As in her previous bills, McCollum's latest bill would also prohibit U.S. funding for Israel's detention and ill treatment of Palestinian children and the annexation of Palestinian land. The bill would also impose strict and detailed certification and reporting requirements on the Secretary of State. These requirements would verify whether the U.S. funding prohibitions were being met and provide details on the nature and extent of Israeli colonization, forced displacement of Palestinians, and ill treatment of Palestinian children. Israel currently enjoys a unique exemption in U.S. law that enables it to spend approximately one quarter of U.S. weapons funding on its own domestic weapons manufacturers. All other countries receiving funds from U.S. taxpayers for weapons are required to spend this allocation exclusively on U.S. weapons makers. By opposing and prohibiting funding to many of the Israeli policies of military occupation that violate the human rights of the Palestinian people, and by increasing the transparency around U.S. weapons flows to Israel, McCollum's latest bill is the boldest effort ever by Congress to ensure that the United States is no longer complicit in Israel's denial of freedom to 5 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. That is why we have to pressure our congressional delegates to get on board as co-sponsors to the McCollum bill. At the very least, we have to recover Clark, McGovern, and Moulton as co-sponsors of H.R. 2590. We know what to do to accomplish that. We just have to do it. As a Palestinian youth, Suleiman Khatib encountered the occupation in his village and attempted to fight back, stabbing an Israeli. Imprisoned at the age of 14, he began a process of political and spiritual transformation still unfolding today. In a book, he asked Penina Eilberg-Schwartz, an American Jew, to write with him. And based on years of conversation between them, Khatib shares how his activism became deeply rooted in the belief that we must ground all work, from dialogue to direct action, in healing, in recognition of the history and humanity of the other. He reveals how he became convinced that Palestinian freedom can flourish alongside Jewish connection in the land where he was born. Their book, In This Place Together, has now been published. This morning's feature presentation is a conversation between the authors, Suleiman and Penina, and is moderated by Peter Beinart.
Hello and welcome to the Occupied Thoughts podcast. I'm Peter Beinart, a non-resident fellow with the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Today I'm joined by Suleiman Khatib and Penina Eilberg-Schwartz, authors of a brand new book, In This Place Together. Suleiman, or Suli, is a Palestinian from Hizmeh, a village next to Jerusalem. He became active against the Israeli occupation and was imprisoned by Israel at age 14 for 10 years. Suli has been on a journey of spiritual and political transformation, which led him to co-found the group Combatants for Peace, together with other former Palestinian combatants and former Israeli Jewish soldiers. Penina is an American Jewish writer and activist. She and Suli worked together to write this book, which the publisher says is, quote, a narrative meditation on joint nonviolence, opening a window to the questions of power, multiple narratives, and imagination that touch on struggles for justice everywhere. I'm excited to be joined by Penina and Suli today to discuss these topics, Palestinian rights, Israeli oppression, the possibilities and challenges of shared struggle, which are particularly relevant today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Suli, I wanted to start with you. Just tell me a little bit about how this book came to be.
Thank you, Peter, for this interview. And for the book, I've been active most of my life. So usually in the framework of Combatants for Peace, and sometimes personally, we do share our personal stories with different audience, and our background and the transformation, and how we became together, like in our group. So a few people has told me that I should write my story. So I'm not a writer. So I thought, I knew Penina from before, and I know Penina's mom actually, and. So I suggested her in San Francisco. We met in San Francisco, and I suggested her that to work together on this book. Almost 6 years ago.
So maybe, Suli, you could talk a little bit about your personal story, since it is the core of this book. Your experiences when you were growing up, and how it led you to the work that you're doing now.
My background, basically, in three quick short parts, is at the time before jail, like my childhood, I grew up, as you said, in a village northeast Jerusalem called Hizmeh. So I born in Jerusalem, actually. And as a young Palestinian boy, in the school, my school, politics was not allowed, actually. So I participated in raising Palestinian flags and writing slogans of Free Palestine on the wall. I was very active compared to my generation, I would say. My older brother was also in jail, so I interacted with the prisoners community and ex-prisoners. At the age of 14, I led a small group of kids to struggle against the occupation using cocktail Molotov and in order to have weapons, we stabbed two Israelis, and this ended up with a slightly wounded for the two Israelis. So at age of 14 and 5 months, I ended up in the Israeli jail. I was the youngest prisoner, a political prisoner at the time.
And what year was this? What year was this?
This was 1986.
1986, okay.
Yeah, I born in 1972. So just... During the jail time, I was part of Fatah movement, led by Arafat, and I was very active also in jail, participating in different actions that the prisoners took, like the food hunger strike, mainly like for 17 days, 16 days, or 10 days. And that was part of my change and seeing the power of nonviolence through hunger strikes and different strategies that we use in jail to improve the daily life in jail. Usually we succeed to achieve most of our demands in the hunger strikes. So my teenager time, I spent it in jail. I spent 10 years and 5 months. I was sentenced to 15 years, actually. Yeah, so in jail also, I worked in the library, as people can read a lot about the details in the book, but in a short, I worked in the library. I also studied about the civil rights movements in America, Martin Luther King, about Nelson Mandela, that he was in jail himself, and other nonviolence leaders. And also, I would say, this is connecting to Palestinian nonviolence historical practice that called sumud, means steadfastness. So we have this in our culture, actually, just to say. And among many other like actions that we did in jail, I became more open. I studied also English and Hebrew in jail. So just to say, jail is not a university. We used to call it a revolutionary university. For some people, this was opportunity to practice nonviolence and education, alternative education, to create leaders in different organizations in jail. Of course, like there was a time also with a lot of violence in jail and psychological torture and physical torture when I was 14 and a half, especially in the investigation time. And sometimes like also a lot of tear gas in the rooms and the cells in, inside jail and many other humiliation of the prisoners' rights. Like it's hundreds of tools that are used against the prisoners also as a humiliation and torture. For me, like and some maybe other prisoners, I would say this is an important part of my personal story and a story of many thousands of Palestinians, unfortunately, that were in jail and the thousands that still in jail, including women and kids, because for Israelis, they don't recognize the prisoners as war prisoners or Geneva Accord for the prisoners' rights. So we have always to struggle to improve the daily life in jail. In jail, like some people, maybe I also reached the conclusion practically that there is no military solution for our conflict. And this is actually used later on after jail in Combatants for Peace and some other groups, that people that fought in their hands reached the same conclusion. But for me, this is not just like a strategy to use nonviolence to end the occupation rather than a philosophy. I believe nonviolence choice is much harder than violence from a real experience. Through the jail time, I has gone through a long, long journey. The change is not easy, obviously, like in the different levels spiritually, it's not just intellectual question, you know, especially when you are inside the jail. But after jail time, I devoted myself to the core of my struggle in a first place for our cause, that I believe there is no other way of liberation for our people separately from each other. I meant to say Palestinians and Israeli Jews. And the idea of either us or them, for me, it's just idea from the past. I'm no longer there. And I searched for, in the second Intifada, after my release, I searched also for Palestinians and Israeli partners. And that's how we came to create Combatants for Peace. The founders were Israeli, ex-Israeli officers and ex-Palestinian prisoners that reached the same conclusion from different places. Of course, I'm aware of the power dynamic and differences in both sides, let's say. But a few people have to find like a common ground and create a new story, let's say, by sharing our personal stories and coming together. And that's how we created Combatants for Peace almost 15 years ago. Maybe for the people don't know, there's a really interesting documentary about Combatants for Peace called Disturbing the Peace. And that described the work of this organization.
Oh, that's great. So Penina, how about you? How did you come to, as an American Jew, how did you come to being part of telling Suli's story?
Yeah, well, I grew up in California, daughter of two very different rabbis, which I can share more about later if you want. But I grew up very rooted in the community, and then, like many other young American Jews, sort of went through a process of becoming quite angry about what hadn't been shared with me about the reality of life under occupation for Palestinians. So went through my own process around that, again, which I could share more about if you want. But all that to say, I was sort of deep in the work of trying to find my place in the movement for Palestinian freedom when I met Suli, and that was at the house of my mother, like he said, and she had met him and been really moved by his story, and asked him to come speak in Minnesota, where she lived at the time, so I happened to be at my mom's house when Suli was there, and we hit it off, and also, like, immediately got into an argument, which is in the book, where my mom asked him to sleep in a room where there was an Israeli flag. And I was very angry that she was asking him to do that. And he was telling me to calm down. And I think our friendship started on those lines of sort of us in this interesting conversation of me sort of being angry and Suli telling me to calm down, and more complex iterations of that political disagreement. So we were friends for some time. And I think after that first meeting, Suli actually introduced me to my first job on Israel-Palestine stuff, which was at a small organization called the Rebuilding Alliance. I had worked at the New Israel Fund, was just sort of trying to find my place in the work. When Suli asked me to work on this, Suli, I think you asked me on Facebook a number of times before San Francisco, and I said no a number of times because I didn't quite understand what my position in relation to this work would be and why that would make sense. But there was something about the moment in San Francisco when Suli came and asked me again in person to work on the book that made me sort of see a pathway for this and why it would make sense for me to be a part of it. And I think there were two pieces of that. One, I had really seen over the years the way that Suli's story and his way of using language and on all levels has been and continues to be a really powerful tool for sort of piercing through the barrier that can be present, especially for American Jews, who I think are tend to be on guard when listening to Palestinian stories. And I thought that there was something really powerful about that. There could be something really powerful about amplifying that story through a book. And then I also, you know, through talking with Suli that day in San Francisco and understanding what his interest in my sort of presence in the book would be, I also became interested in this idea of using the book. I wasn't quite sure in what way yet, to as an example of joint work. So, like, really investigating what does it mean to make this book about joint work in a joint situation where Suli and I are coming from positions of really large power differential. Me as a white American Jew, Suli as a Palestinian living under occupation. There are other axes of power at play as well, like gender, and sort of trying to figure out, like, how can we, you know, in addition to the main goal of the book, which is to share Suli's story and his vision and the stories of many other people who shaped him, to how to use the book with a secondary purpose as well, as a way to explore what it means to work across difference, and what that says about the outside world, the systems of power we're living under, and how we might use those lessons in our struggles for justice. So, yeah.
That's great. So I wanted to pick up on that point. You know, there is a Palestinian campaign, an anti-normalization campaign about against working with Israelis in contexts which would not be directly in support of ending Palestinian oppression. And you yourself, right, you talk in the book about, you know, concerns that you might have had about accusations made against you because of your work with Israelis, that maybe you're even a spy. So I wanted just to ask you how you think about this subject, given the power dynamics and given the debate that exists among Palestinians on this question.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. This is like a question that we live with for years. So let me say this, that in the context of the anti-normalization thing, I am aware this is the ideas that we are talking about are not a mainstream ideas, neither in the Palestinian side, neither in the Israeli side. So obviously with all the pain and the history and the trauma and the suffering and living under the occupation, of course, people are, many people are not ready to, let's say, work with the other side. And we know this from South Africa experience, from Ireland, from other places. And even the word normalization exists in South African language, the local language, I forget the word, because in Arabic we call it tatbiya, and in North Ireland, in Ireland, in both sides. So I'm really aware since I started reaching out to the other side that there will be a price for that. Socially, and some friends even will be different than you, of course, and some people will call you are not Palestinian anymore. In the same time, my Israeli friends that we did together the Memorial Day last night, we'll talk about it later, also they has been called as cheating. They are not Israelis anymore. And their love with Arab and so on. So, I don't really know any like a solution for this question. I'm thinking there is no one strategy to change the system and end the occupation. So I believe the strategies that I believe in them, which is under the line of joint struggle and nonviolence, are totally legitimate and moral strategies. And it's open for criticism, obviously, as long as it's not like a life threat or something. I live in Ramallah and I don't hide my public activism with Israelis, like in my social media, for example, and in my real life, to be honest. And as we speak always, like you lose some people and you gain a new community and a new friends and new alliances that are not based on your, let's say, ethnic group. And I never, sometimes I got criticism, of course, like personally or our organization, of course, like even yesterday I looked at the Memorial Day, the joint memorial event in Arabic because we had a page in Arabic. So some people are supportive and some people are like, for them, this is beyond any imagination. And there's a lot of criticism. And I think this is fine for me. As long as the conversation is respectful and it doesn't take my Palestinian, you know, identity away, I am totally fine. And sometimes I have to say, Peter, the criticism is not coming specifically from Palestinian, which is legitimate criticism. I have to say sometimes it's coming from more privileged white American person. And that's more like annoying to me than if it come from Palestinians, to be honest.
Yeah. Penina, I wanted to ask you about the kind of the theory of change. You know, this is something I think about a lot myself. You know, I'm also an American Jew, and I have seen that people be, at least for the moment, opened up or maybe destabilized by seeing a reality or hearing a story, encountering Palestinian humanity, encountering the utter brutality of what Israel does. But I also sometimes wonder, well, what happens? Is that enough? Or does that just, do people just close back down? Or sometimes they just think they know, but then they, you know, get back to their normal lives and they think, well, you know, the costs might be pretty high for me. So I guess my question to you is how much change do you think in the Jewish community is possible through this kind of storytelling and truth telling? And how much requires pressure? And how do the two work together?
Yeah.
But nonviolent pressure, obviously. Good.
Totally. I don't think it's enough, at all. No question. And I think actually when I entered the book, I think I was more suspicious of the sort of heart opening storytelling thing than I am now. I think that it's one tool among many. So I do believe that we need work like this that allows people to open their hearts a little bit in an area where their trauma doesn't get activated and they can start to like change slowly. And that also needs to happen multiple times, you know, across the course of somebody's process in order to actually move them towards action. And I think we also need the pressure, as you said. I mean, we need direct action. We need people to be challenged directly. And I believe actually, like you said at the end of your question, that those strategies really support each other. And so we need, you know, we need JVP and we need International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network and we need J Street and we need Combatants for Peace and we need storytelling. We need all these things, I think, so that people have different entry points and different experiences that sort of move them along in their process. And of course, you know, our end goal is not to move people along in their process towards supporting liberation. Our end goal is liberation. But, you know, the reality is that changing people's hearts and minds is an important strategy in social justice movements and has always been so. And I think, yeah, I just wanted to add something I think about a lot. I'm going to forget the person's name, who is a former white supremacist, who's now doing anti-racist education. And I remember hearing him on the radio somewhere, and he was in school in Florida, and I think he sort of got outed as a racist, and you know, people were yelling at him and calling him names and you know, kicking him out of the community. And there was an Orthodox Jewish person who invited him to his house for Shabbat, and they started having Shabbat dinners. He was a white supremacist, also anti-Semitic. And anyway, that was part of his process of transformation. And on the radio show, the interviewer asked him like, oh, isn't this an incredible example of what dialogue can do? And he said, yes. And also, I don't think that gesture of this person opening their home to me would have meant the same thing without the context of the pressure of the people calling me names. And that's what I believe. I think we need both and that those things really, really support each other in the end, to both move individuals along in their process and also move us communally towards where we need to be to fight for liberation for Palestinians and all people.
So I wanted to ask you, you know, you speak to a lot of American Jews, you know, you work with a lot of Israelis, you make yourself very vulnerable by talking about these brutal experiences that you've had. And I imagine that, you know, sometimes you probably get, you know, people who respond in a variety of different ways. But I wonder, when you think about what you want to come out of these encounters, I'm wondering if there have been moments when you've been disappointed by how people have behaved after you told them your story, either Israelis or diaspora Jews, and if there are other particular moments when you've been really gratified, you know, by things that you've seen that people have done after experiencing what you've gone through.
Honestly, my real experience with encounters and talking to like specifically Israelis or American Jews in generally, I have to say, firstly, not everybody is willing to listen to people like myself. So there is that also. So I'm aware that we meet certain type of people usually.
Yes.
That's important to say. And second, I want to say, like, in my experience, like change, there is no one way to change people's heart or soften their hearts. There is, and it can take time. Sometimes it's in one meeting. It happened with me, like, let's say with Encounter, where I meet a group of American Jews usually, and twice they brought Israelis to Ramallah, which is important to break also the fear and the psychological barriers to meet in a nice place in Ramallah. Usually I think because we are talking about personal stories, I feel more openness in the eyes of the people that I meet. I encounter a lot of people from these meetings, not just with me, with other Palestinian voices also, that really changed their life. And they, like many of them, still writing us, and some of them are one of the most like activists in Combatants for Peace. We met actually not even in a lecture or a talk, and accidentally in an Ethiopian restaurant in Jerusalem. And somehow we start conversation, and I give her the website of Combatants for Peace, and she's now leading the educational program in Combatants for Peace, and she's also going to the field in Jordan Valley to support Palestinian Shepherd every day. Kochav, her name, for example. So when I see people like this, this gives me a lot of hope. And of course, like, it's not always easy and it's not smooth. And as you said, like, you to go back to the personal trauma and jail and torture and details like that, it's challenging. But I think that a personal story and storytelling is one of the best tools to really reach out to people and dehumanize our stories all. And sometimes, I encounter people that are really hard, especially when I used to go around with Disturbing the Peace with the movie. Mm-hmm. I met some people, like one Israeli man that he couldn't sit in the movie watching, and he told me that he killed people in his hand, and he left the house where we screened the movie, and then we supposed to talk, me and one of the my friends from Combatants for Peace, Maya Katz. Yeah, there's like heavy moments happening sometimes. Also, we bought the movie in Ramallah, and a few people left before they, at the beginning of the movie, because they couldn't sit on the table. They thought this is a Zionist narrative here. So there is like moments like this. I can tell you, we also screened the movie in the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles. I was surprised, like, one woman, like, was shouting there and said, there is no Palestinian people. These people doesn't exist. So I was there with the producer of the movie, Steve Apkin, and Marcina Hill, and Jamil, and other Asaf, I believe, a few of us there. Yeah, we were really calm, and so I just have to use sarcasm. I told her, yes, we didn't exist ever. Me and Jamil just came from the sky right now. We never exist. So, of course, we encounter a lot of reactions. Yeah. But I learned, like, I also studied some nonviolence communication, where it helps us to communicate with people where they are at, not where we want them to be. And this is, like, important to be aware of that.
Right. Panini, you write at the beginning of the book about your apprehensions about the power dynamics. And I wonder, and these are power dynamics that don't only exist between Jews and Palestinians, they exist in many other different contexts. And I think can pose real challenges for people who enjoy certain rights and privileges and want to engage with changing that, but also want to do so without kind of replicating those same structures of power and privilege. And I'm just wondering what you learned through your experience with Suli in writing this book that might help others in thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean, my first response is that I don't have any good answers to that question, except to really be interested always in paying attention and being really curious about what comes up. And doing a lot of work to learn about these things. I think, you know, my background also, I remember when I was starting in, like, working on Palestine Israel stuff, I was reading a lot of Wahat HaSalam Neve Shalom's pedagogy on dialogue, which is very much about, you know, what are the power dynamics that are showing up in a dialogue space and how do you reflect that to the participants? And then how do you reflect that in such a way that they're moved to go back out in the world and A, be aware of their relation to systems of power, and then B, shake it up and try to find ways to slip the trap of those systems. So I think there's a lot of really wonderful resources on it. I've also learned a lot from being a part of Surge, which is, you know, domestic US racial justice organization, primarily white people struggling in solidarity with Black, Indigenous, and other people of color led movements. So I'd say, you know, read about this, like read, it, you know, if you're white, if you're Jewish, like read about people who have been in this struggle for a long time and how, what they have learned and how they approach it. Pay attention, like know that no matter what, like these things are going to come up. We are all products of the systems that that are outside, whether it's racism or anti-Semitism or patriarchy, colonialism, all of these things, and they all show up in our relationships, and we should expect that they will. And we should be curious about it, and just try to then be responsive to whatever comes up. I'm not sure that I have any. I think I say in the book at one point that I don't have a map for it, and that feels very true. I don't have a clean answer to that question. I wish that I did. But I'm, and maybe this is just obvious, but certainly I was always thinking about how much space I took up in, certainly in the book and in conversations and interviews, the ways that I was sort of drawing Suli out, how that, what that might have been connected to. I was certainly aware when we were talking about really difficult things about Suli's history with having been tortured and interrogated. And like, what does this mean for me to be like drawing information out of him? Things like that I was thinking about, and I would encourage people to be present with that. Trying to think if there's anything else. I mean, I think that the other thing, this is sort of a tangent to your question, but something that I did think was important in the book is that, you know, I made a decision and with Suli that like I wouldn't be an invisible writer. And I think that traditionally often that is the person in power's way of trying to reckon with their power to not be visible. This is a really fraught and important conversation, and I'm not convinced that I have the right answer on this. But my feeling when I started writing, and my feeling now still, is that it's important to not pretend to be invisible, because we're not, because our power, when we're coming from the privileged position, is at play, and we need to be able to reckon with that. And we can't do that if we're pretending that it's not there. I'll leave it there.
That's great. Suli, I want to end by asking you to talk a little bit about the joint memorial ceremony that was held just this week. And this is something which is, I think, been growing over the years, and to talk about the significance of that.
So the joint memorial day, we used to call it alternative memorial day. Since a few years, we call it the Palestinian-Israeli Joint Memorial Day, because we want to create a new reality. And this is part of the theory of change that we're trying here. So the idea came like really 15, 16 years ago, and we held like a small ceremony of 70 people maybe attending, and nobody knew about it anyway at the time. The second year, we have 200 people. The third year, we had like 500, 1,000. And the year before Corona, we actually had the biggest ceremony physically in a park in Tel Aviv. We had 9,000 to 10,000 people with a small demonstration of extreme right wingers against us, that they used violence actually against the participants. So, and since last year, because of Corona, we used the Zoom and online. So we had 200,000 people watch last year. So it became a really kind of global event, which I really believe this is a universal value. it's not fitting just for Israelis and Palestinians, rather to the world. And this year, as far as I know, I don't have the exact number, but we had a meeting last night after the ceremony on Zoom for all our team. And the numbers I heard, they crossed the numbers of last year, like 280,000 something. So I don't have the exact number. But so we had last night one station in Tel Aviv and one in Beit Jala with different arrangements due to the corona, because we don't have vaccination yet. I myself got corona last week, so I couldn't join personally. So I was doing a Zoom afterwards from home. I think this is like a proof of many things. Like one, that small group of people really can participate in this change making. And definitely we appreciate that we had like 120 organizations sponsoring the joint memorial day. And that's why it became visible for many people around the world. So it's not just like Combatants for Peace and our partners in the Family Forum. I believe like that one of the most important tools here is really to work with different groups, actually. And we'll have the Nakba ceremony next month, organized by Combatants for Peace and other partners. I hope to that they will join that. And this is a taboo conversation for the Israelis. The Nakba is not exist in the education system or in the normal system. So this is part of like the daily work we do here. It's as Nina mentioned, I also believe there is no one strategy in one way. There is direct action happening on the ground. There is a call for demonstration Saturday in Sheikh Jarrah against the evacuation of Palestinian families in East Jerusalem. There is a bunch of events happening through the year, thousands of lectures with all kinds of audience. So we're trying our best, actually, and that gives me a lot of hope. The new story that we're trying to create and to let it born here is really happened step by step by people that trying a new thinking in support of this new narrative. And as they say, and this is maybe I finished here, like the reality is hard and complex and there is a lot of hopelessness. But stories like the Memorial Day, the Joint Memorial Day, the Nakba ceremony, the activism that happened every day on the ground, that's what give us hope and that's what keep us going, actually.
Thank you. The book is called In This Place Together. Thank you so much, Penina and Suli, for our conversation today. And thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of the Occupied Thoughts podcast, a project of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. You can visit our website at fmvp.org to subscribe to our many resources and to find today's podcast episode posted along with links to additional resources about this topic. You can also subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Spotify. I'm Peter Beinart. I look forward to our next episode. Thank you so much again, Suli and Penina.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for having us. Thanks.
That was a conversation between Suleiman Khatib and Penina Eilberg-Schwartz, authors of the book In This Place Together. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM, every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved in the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week. Good morning.